The Conversation Hour with John Fain on 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
My co-host today is Waleed Ali, community leader in the Islamic community here in Melbourne. He's a Richmond supporter, an academic now at Monash University rather than a lawyer. Waleed, welcome back to the Conversation Hour.
Thank you. I'm not really a community leader.
No, okay. Richo, he needs a bit of bleeding. How's the hamstrings?
Well, I don't know, but what I read, not very good.
What's going wrong at Richmond? They can't manage their stars.
Last time I was here, you did this to me as well.
Oh, I'm sorry. All right, let's talk about something else.
No, I'm just, you know.
I've got your type card.
I'm just wondering if this is some kind of pattern that's disclosing.
I respond to stereotype.
Yeah, obviously. No, look, Richo's in trouble. Will he play again is the question.
How old is he now?
34. But apparently he's basically 21. He just happens to be 34.
Right, he's a 21-year-old and a 34-year-old man's body.
Oh, gee. No.
You can say that about Ben Cousins, actually.
But yeah, well, so, no, this is the thing, right? Because he did that injury against North Melbourne, and then he played the next week, and then suddenly he's out. So that's the big thing. And Cousins was a similar story. And in both cases, they were unrelated injuries.
But they were sent back out.
So there seem to be a lot of unrelated injuries that just coincidentally occur.
No. It's about a team that's desperate for a win, risking its stars and losing on the gamble.
Yeah, but I don't think it works. Like, well, we'll see you don't win that way.
Well, when Geelong's way ahead and they're coasting and Gary Ablett gets a bit of groin soreness, they pull him off the field before it gets worse. When Richmond's stars get a bit of soreness, they're sent back out there because they're so desperate for success, they're prepared to risk them.
But isn't it true that Richmond win more games when Richo's not there than when he is?
You are so cruel. And for a Richmond supporter.
No, I love Richo. I should actually clear this up because there was a bit of a kerfuffle apparently towards the end of last year. I wrote an essay on Richo. For the Footy Almanac, this thing that John Harbs and Paul Daffy put together. It's got reports on every game of the year, and there's a preface on Richo, and I wrote it. And it was basically my love letter to Richo. It was explaining why I think he's so exceptional and why he should be admitted into the pantheon of people who only have one name, if you know what I mean. And in it, I was explaining the phenomenon that is Richo, and I said that the thing that's so great about him is that he embodies contradiction, and in that he reminds us of us, which is unlike any other footballer. I mean, the champions are in a way, normally they're not of us. They do things that we can't do, whereas Richo does things that nobody can do, but then he does all the things that we do as well. And so
if he played for a more successful club, would he attract as much attention?
I just think Richo. It's hard for someone like Richo not to attract attention. It's what it is about him is the character that is expressed.
The charisma.
Yeah. And Richmond is the perfect fit for him because it's such a oddly dysfunctional, inspiring, yet hopelessly disappointing club. And but here's the thing, and this is a kind of point that I made in that preface, was that in a way, Richo's too good a player to win a premiership. Like he's
too good.
Yeah, because he's too unpredictable. He's too
win a premiership.
He's too dynamic. He's
that shows a certain acceptance of failure. That statement, doesn't it?
We've had this discussion, Richmond. Yeah. There is something in the water at Richmond. I've said this before.
Yeah. Who do you want to coach them next?
I think if the second coming of Jesus occurred before Terry Wallace finished, he would probably make a good Richmond coach.
Someone's written about that.
Really? I'd like to know.
Philip Adams.
Oh, really?
A long time.
Did he suggest that Jesus...
He reported on a billboard outside a church in Hawthorne.
Oh, the Peter Hudson one.
What would you do if God came to Hawthorne was the billboard outside the church encouraging people to come to church, and someone graffitied on it, move Peter Hudson to centre half forward.
Yeah. That was clearly a 70s thing when the full forward was dominant. Now it's a coach. Because I've updated.
Yes, well, see, that's the trouble. The game's not about the umpires. It's about the coaches. Mm. And, of course, it should be about the players.
Yeah.
Do you want the umpires
There's too many players.
Unmiked? Unplugged?
I cannot contain my indifference on this issue. Well, I mean, does it really matter?
Yeah.
Why?
Because... I mean, I think sometimes it helps, and when you're watching it on the television, which I occasionally do, although more often I listen to it on the radio, but when you hear what the umpires are saying, and occasionally they do make a bit of a fuss and theatrics overtake function and form, sometimes they do get a bit too carried away, and they're clearly self-important, and I wish they'd just get on with
that's
it.
That's not a function of miking.
Yes, it is, because they're performing for an audience in the same way that lawyers in court would perform more flamboyantly if it was being telecast.
I don't know that the mic is ever present in their mind.
They respond to a bigger audience.
Really?
Yes, and then they watch themselves and listen to themselves and analyse it.
Surely at some point they just kind of, they're lost in actually doing their job.
No. In the moment.
Well, they're concentrating on something. It's like I reckon players are aware of the crowd.
No.
But I don't know that...
When they review their performance, they review how they went on the field and how they performed for the media, because it's a business. Mm. It's all about generating eyeballs for television and ears for commercial radio. It's a business, and the umpires are part of the show.
So you think they would umpire better if they weren't marked?
Yep.
I like the fact they're marked, because then you actually get to see the reason that you're so upset with them.
Yeah.
And it's something good.
It doesn't change that you are upset with them.
No, it makes you more upset.
Yeah, sometimes.
Isn't that kind of what it's about?
No.
Because there's only one thing that unites football fans, and that is a hatred of umpires.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So the more ignorant you are about their activity, the more united you are. And you can be confounded, be confused, and you can yell at each other and exchange jokes about each other. Oh, he's on your side. No, he's what about that one? What about in the third quarter when he was running around the boundary? It was clearly out. No, it wasn't.
Knowledge is power.
No.
And knowing...
Not in this case.
Knowing that they gave the 50-metre penalty because you called him a nasty name unites football fans in a way that else does.
You could speculate about the 50-metre penalty just as well.
Yeah, but that's not as good.
Yes, it is.
No, it's not.
Waleed Ali is my co-host on The Conversation Hour today. Can music help when you've got cancer? In this hour, we're going to meet Tony, who is dealing with ovarian cancer, and I might say she'll tell us more. It's not a happy story at the moment for Tony, and she's going to tell us about the work she's doing with her music therapist, Emma, as we have a look at the issue of music therapy and cancer treatment. But our first guest joining us in just a moment here on 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria, on The Conversation Hour, is our colleague from Four Corners, Sally Neighbour, who over the years has made many distinguished programs about a range of things, but it's her recent work following terrorism around Southeast Asia in particular that led her to an introduction with a most remarkable woman. How do you go from being a surfy chick stoned with your boyfriend on the northern beaches of Sydney to bumping into Osama bin Laden at a training camp in Pakistan or near the Afghan border? How do you go from being a child convert to Catholicism to being a fanatical Muslim? How do you reconcile the teachings of Islam with multiple failed marriages and partners siring a gaggle of children, two of whom won't talk to you anymore? These are just some of the paradoxes in the story that Sally Neighbour tells us in a book she's just written called The Mother of Muhammad, An Australian Woman's Extraordinary Journey into Jihad. And it's the story of a Robin, now called Rabia Hutchison. And Sally will tell her story as our first guest in just a moment.
On 774 ABC Melbourne.
Sally Neighbour is a Four Corners journalist, but she's here because she's written a book about a woman she's been meeting regularly with over the course of at least a year. The Mother of Muhammad is the story of Rabia Hutchison, who has gone from being a stoned, surfy chick on Sydney's northern beaches to wandering around in Afghanistan and Pakistan in terrorist training camps and even personally meeting Osama bin Laden. And as I said, it's a book and a story full of paradox. Sally, welcome to The Conversation Hour.
Thank you for having me.
Never heard of anyone having an epiphany over a pizza before. What sort of a pizza was it that led to the epiphany for Robin Hutchinson?
Well, it was the pork in the pizza that led to the epiphany for Robin Hutchinson. Not the pineapple, no. It was when she looked at the pork and realised that she wasn't supposed to be eating this, that she was suddenly faced with this dilemma over what sort of Muslim am I, and decided at that moment, when her life was in crisis in many ways, that Islam was going to be her salvation.
And in fact, these crises seem to occur with extraordinary regularity in this woman's life. How many times has she been married?
She's been married 6 times. 3 of those marriages are documented in the book. The other 3 are not, because she didn't want to talk about them. So
she
I can give you the details of 3 of them. But
just didn't want to talk about them.
She said they weren't important in her life.
How many children?
She's got 6 children.
To how many of those husbands?
To 2 husbands.
Right.
That's not a gaggle.
No, and she's got 2 of those children who refuse to talk to her anymore.
Yes. Well, whether they refuse to talk to her, she's not in contact with them.
Yeah.
So, yes, they're not speaking. That's true.
Okay. And her family, half of whom won't talk to her anymore, the family she was born into.
Yeah. But lots of people have troubled family relationships. Yeah. She's not the only woman in the world whose kids, you know, don't like her, or two of them don't. You know, the other four are extremely fond of her. She's not the only person who has arguments around the family dinner table. Not at Christmas, I should say. I was going to say Christmas lunch. But
they might have arguments around Christmas time, but...
I suspect they just don't talk at all at Christmas time.
Right.
But no, she's had a turbulent life, but I don't think she's on her own in that. That's, I mean, right. Women like her, with gaggles of children to different men in much greater numbers, are exposed on A Current Affair and Today Tonight every night.
That's why I'm wondering, John, why are you so fascinated by that?
I think it's an indication of someone who is searching, and that's what this book to me was all about. This is a woman who, from her childhood, throwing herself wholeheartedly into the Red Cross and loving the uniform and the sense of belonging. And then she goes from there. She's described as a bit of a school bully at high school. And over again, whatever she's into it 150%, including as a convert to Islam. Is that the sort of character that she is?
Yeah, that's the sort of character she is. But I think, again, there's lots of people who are searching and were searching. I mean, she grew up in the 1970s, you know, hippie chick. Her boyfriend was a junior surfing champion. They were all sort of getting into Buddhism and, you know, all sorts of other faiths and belief systems that they were exploring. So,
mostly
and,
marijuana.
You know, well, including marijuana and LSD and, you know, the odd delving into more serious drugs. But, you know, a lot of people are searching for meaning in life, and a lot of people find it in faith. And, you know, the story of a Western man or woman converting to Islam, it certainly isn't unusual. So, yeah, she was certainly searching, and she was searching for clarity and purpose and discipline and a moral order. And I think that's what she found in Islam, having had a turbulent younger life and family life.
Which is why the brand of Islam that she likes is extremely clear-cut, very austere. It provides that kind of anchor.
Yeah, that's true. Mind you, I think I would say that even moderate Islam provides for some people, you know, clarity and moral order and self-discipline and respect. So
not just Islam. I mean, lots of people find that in all sorts of religions cults
that's
too.
That's true.
Insofar as there's a difference between them,
yeah,
which is an interesting.
Well, it's interesting. Cults is interesting though, because a lot of people who get into cults have religious cults, have irreligious pasts. So what you find is a kind of feeling of guilt in the past and a kind of overcompensation, which explains the total...
What's the difference between a cult and a religion?
A cult is usually a religious innovation. So a cult...
So modernity is the difference. One's just been made up recently, the other was made up thousands of years ago.
Yeah, the difference between a cult and a sect is that a cult is actually preaching something entirely, like, new. So it's a new prophet or a new something, whereas a sect is usually more restorative. It's about...
Yeah, but that's changing. A cult and a religion, one's old, the other's new.
Not really, because...
Sally, do you think?
Well, I think a cult or a sect is a kind of branching off from a larger faith, I would have said.
Scientology didn't branch off anything. It's regarded as a religion and a cult by some people.
Yeah, but it is classified as
someone
a religion,
made it up.
Isn't it?
Now it is, for tax purposes.
Yeah, that's right.
Other people
there's
say
a,
no, that's
There's
a few
things a with
joke.
Cults, though. Yes, there's the whole, it's a new religion or at least a new innovation within a religious tradition. But it's also small in number, and that's pretty crucial, and it has zero authority structures outside the core of the movement. So there's normally a central charismatic figure, whereas religions are not necessarily like that.
I think it's probably possible to see Salafism or Wahhabism as a sect or a cult, or, you know, a cult-like branch of Islam. What do you think?
No, I don't think so. I think it's a sect. It's clearly a sect, but it's not a cult, because there's no... A cult requires a central figure that binds the whole thing together and has unquestionable
Jesus,
authority.
Jesus, Muhammad, what's the difference?
No, because A, they're not alive. B, their messages are contested, and they admit for a plurality of interpretations. Whereas with a cult leader, you have a cult leader that's there giving very specific orders to very specific people who respond directly to them.
Let's save that, because if we continue down that path, we're not going to get to the story that Sally's here to tell us about Rabia. She wanted to be noticed, is the other consistent theme. She goes through life and discovers Islam, gets more and more involved, goes to Indonesia, marries a man, da-da-da-da-da, travels around the world, goes to Egypt, goes to the Middle East, all sorts of places. It seems the consistent thread is she wanted to be part of something and she wanted to be noticed. Is that the sort of character we're dealing with?
One of her friends remembers of her in high school that she wanted to be noticed, which is a comment she makes because in high school she was a very out there girl. She was, you know, very outgoing, quite outrageous in some of the things she would do, very popular, very likeable. But, I mean, people also say she was warm and funny and genuine and caring. So, you know, she wasn't kind of this attention-seeking freak by any means. But, yeah, that's certainly something that someone says about her. I think it's certainly true that she wanted to be a part of something. She wanted to find the place where she belonged. And she certainly felt that she found that in Islam, but particularly she found it in, you know, this kind of fairly extreme practice of Islam, or communities where Islam is practiced in a quite puritanical way.
So what do we learn, those of us who aren't caught up in this zealotry? What do we learn about people who are so attracted, whether it's to the Hare Krishnas or Buddhism or whatever else it might be? People are so attracted that they go right in to the point where she's regarded as a threat to national security now and under constant surveillance.
I don't personally think it's a story about zealotry. I mean, to me, the Islamist movement has been the most important political movement of the last 20 years, let's say. I mean, disagree with that if you like, but I mean, it's clearly one of the most, if not the most important political movements, and it's been an incredibly enduring movement and a growing movement. And
you call it a political movement deliberately?
I think it's a political movement, yes.
That's what it is by definition.
Mm. Yeah. And so, you know, we have to try and understand this. We can't just kind of continue to depict these people as cardboard cutout zealots and maniacs as we have depicted, for example, the Bali bombers, and that's reasonable, but people like Abu Bakr Bashir, it's a bit less reasonable. Mm-hmm. I mean, my view as a journalist is that we have to at least try and understand this, because it is a massive political movement in the world and one that has redefined our world. And so, from my point of view, a way that we can understand it is to try and explore who these people are and why they're drawn to it.
It's also a very diverse movement.
Sure, absolutely.
And that's part of the thing. Like, it's not necessarily, there's a kind of zealous brand of it. But there's also brands of it that really just are more about sort of social reform and emerge out of that sort of milieu and don't even particularly attract especially religious people necessarily. It kind of proceeds as a social movement. So I think this is where it gets tricky. You kind of need to pick which bits you want to talk about and really drill down and focus on that. And I think, John, what you're interested in is that brand that is cult-like.
Well, no, what I'm interested in is from the point of view of the world facing this incredible challenge to our well-being, our safety, our sense of safety, you know, given that not many people actually die from terrorism, but many of us find our lives are substantially disrupted by and affected by the threat of terrorism and, you know, the impact it's had around the world. I'm fascinated that there are people who go from a completely different background and, like, you know, moths to a candle, they are absolutely fascinated by it to the point where they become players and participants themselves.
Actually, it's disproportionately people like that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The Jack Thomases of this world.
Yeah,
and so
the converts
on.
Have played a really major role and been in key positions. And yeah. I think the converts like Jack Thomas, Jack Roach and so on, David Hicks, have been quite useful to those movements or those particular groups.
Some of the suicide bombers in England who were homegrown, as they called
them,
in England, rather than coming from overseas, and they had middle-class, educated backgrounds and then suddenly found themselves attracted to acts of violence.
But often irreligious backgrounds.
Yeah.
That's the point I make with the cult comparison, is that very often it's kind of an overcompensation.
So what do we learn? What do we learn from what have you learned from studying her life and the people who she was mixing with?
Well, What I've learned, not only from studying her life, but from some of the books that have been written by people like Mark Sageman and Louise Richardson and so on, about, you know, the psychology, if you like, of terrorists, is that a lot of people are drawn to, you know, this extreme brand of Islam because it's very empowering, particularly for men, for a start. It's very empowering. There's a very powerful sense of brotherhood. Islam welcomes converts, and so converts are treated with a special kind of reverence and regard. You know, for men, it means an instant community, respect, an instant wife in many cases. So I think the reasons, and also, you know, the freedom fighter narrative that Bin Laden and that lot have promoted is very powerful. Mm. You know, it's very powerful, and it is a legitimate narrative, I think, for millions of Muslims around the world, you know, who genuinely have experienced oppression and subjugation. And, you know, the feeling...
Or feel solidarity with other Muslims who feel...
Well, that's right. And a really important part of the whole... global movement has been the internet. And so, you know, you have this thing that people refer to as the virtual ummah, the virtual community, so that people in Australia or other non-Muslim societies feel like they are literally a part of this much bigger movement and brotherhood.
And that's happening across fanatical groups everywhere. I mean, I just this morning was giving a lecture on the white supremacist movement, and it's exactly the same thing that you can see happening. The internet is taking disparate groups of people who may or may not have known about each other's grievances and concerns and stitching them together, bringing them as a kind of international community.
Yeah, so people like Rabia feel like they're part of this grand cause and this, you know, historic movement, if you like, you know, to avenge oppression and so on.
Has she read your book?
Yes.
What does she think of it?
She is quite pleased with it.
Because?
You know. Because it tells her story. And when I set out to write the book, and it took me a long time to get her to go along with it, because as I've recounted in the introduction, one of the first things she said to me was, I'll never trust you, because I had written about her and because she doesn't trust journalists at all. But the reason she agreed finally to cooperate with me was that I undertook to tell her story in a way that was faithful to her experience and to her beliefs. And that's what I've tried to do. And it's been a tricky line in some respects, because in some respects I've had to kind of, you know, veer off my normal journalistic objectivity.
Have you become her cheer squad?
No, I don't think so. I haven't yet been accused of that. I might be.
I don't think you glorify her, but she may feel glorified by the mere fact that someone's written a book and we're talking about her, and that, given for an attention seeker, is, you know, we're falling into the little trap ourselves, aren't we?
Look, she hasn't left her home since the book came out a few days ago.
She's posed for photos. I saw a picture in the Weekend magazine.
Oh, yeah, no, that was before the book was published. Since the book was released, she hasn't left her home because she's afraid of a backlash. She hasn't agreed to do any public appearances.
Well, she was going to
she was going to come here today.
What happened?
And then pulled out. Well, because the Australian published a photograph that
a photograph of a woman covered from head to toe except for
a photograph,
two eyes poking
of her without, taken in the 1970s when she was photographed when she was in her 20s.
Yeah, you wouldn't recognise somebody now.
No, but I mean, I made a deliberate decision not to put that photograph in the book.
There's no photos in the book.
No, there's no photos in the book because she doesn't want to show her face. I would have liked photographs, but, you know, it's her choice and it's part of her belief that she doesn't want to show her face. So on the front cover of the book, there's a woman in an Afghani burqa or chador.
Is that her or a model?
It's not actually her, no. It's,
I'm intrigued by the choice of that photo, actually, because she doesn't dress like that.
No, she doesn't dress like that, but that's what she wore in Afghanistan.
Right.
The choice of the photo was simply because it was
sells books.
A nice looking image. Well, no, more books would have been sold if I could have got her face on the cover, but she didn't go along with that.
Her actual face or just her face covered?
Well, I think her actual face on the cover would be much
better
for book sales.
I've just got a feeling, though, that the face veil sells a lot of books.
What does?
The face veil.
I don't know about that. I mean, I think maybe it used to. I don't know if it does or doesn't. I think it may sell some books. I think for some people it's a turn-off.
But is she gratified by it? Is she enjoying the attention?
Well, no. Like I said to you, she won't appear in public. She pulled out of this interview. She hasn't left her home. So, no, she feels she is happy to have her story told in a way that she believes is faithful to her, which I promised. But she feels quite uncomfortable about the attention. She hated the coverage in the newspapers on the weekend.
What did she expect?
So she doesn't want the media coverage.
What on earth did she expect? Do people really think that you can tell your story in such a bizarre story, because it is, and not attract attention?
Well,
wasn't the argument, though, that she was attracting attention anyway? Because there was
she could have slipped off the radar gradually.
That she was attracting attention anyway?
Yeah, I mean, because there was a documentary.
Well, people were writing about her anyway. I had written stories about her. So she was being written about anyway. I mean, she's been a figure of some interest for years.
So the feeling
was... And people have been trying to get to her. She's had offers from commercial television and from magazines.
And you couldn't get her to agree to a Four Corners?
No.
Wouldn't be filmed?
Well, she was that's filmed, a long though. Story. She took part in another program, but
Can I ask you, the process of writing this book?
Yeah.
It's a phenomenal story. You obviously have to spend a lot of time with her in order to get the details. How do you, as a journalist and as an author in this case, avoid being seduced by what must be a fairly charismatic person and her story, actually avoid becoming part of a cause, in a sense?
Yeah. The way I approached it, one of the things I did was try to talk to as many other people as I could about her, and as a result of that, there are, you know, a number of unflattering descriptions and accounts of her in the book. I also did a lot of historic research, and part of the reason I wanted to tell the story was that Rabia has been a witness to extremely important, you know, historic events and episodes. You know, the Islamist movement in Indonesia, taught a teacher at Abu Bakr Bashir's school in Java, you know, in the with the Mujahideen in Pakistan, in Afghanistan under the Taliban, et cetera, et cetera. So to me, it's like, you know, it's a history in a sense, in that she's a witness to historic events and episodes. So I did a lot of historic research. So you'll find in the book, you know, that there is quite a lot of history in there as well. And beyond that, I just kind of used my instincts and, you know, tried to be sceptical. And there was a lot of details that I didn't put in the book because I couldn't corroborate, for example. I tried to corroborate everything she told me.
Oh, that's extensively footnoted. There's 50 or 60 pages of footnotes. Yeah. So I congratulate you on that. Do you think
you were seduced to some degree?
I don't think I was seduced. I do admit that I admire her, that I get on well with her. To me, her story is just so remarkable, it deserves to be told. And I don't judge her. It may be that because I don't judge her, people will consider me to have been seduced, but I don't think that's the case.
Don't shoot the messenger is the answer there. Sally, it's a fascinating tale, and for anyone who's interested in these issues, in particular the rise in the West of particular versions of extreme Islam, then this book is an important thing to read. It's published by Melbourne Uni Press. Sally Naber, Four Corners journalist, is the author, The Mother of Muhammad, An Australian Woman's Extraordinary Journey into Jihad. And Sally is not telling her own story. No. Sally is telling Rabia's story. Our next guests, Tony and Emma, will talk to us about how music can help you with cancer.
abc.net.au/Melbourne.
I'm John Fain. Walid Ali is my co-host. Sally Naber was our first guest, and she's written a book about Rabia Hutchinson called The Mother of Muhammad, which you'll find in, as they say, good bookshops now. But we're completely changing tune now. Emma is a music therapist and Tony is a patient dealing with cancer, ovarian cancer. And they've come in to talk to us about whether or not music can help you when you've got cancer. Tony, Emma, good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Now, Tony, you want to tell your story.
I do.
It's not that we've dragged you in here kicking and screaming. Let's make that clear from the start.
Absolutely. Yes.
What's happened?
I've initially got diagnosed in 2006 and since then, I've had three recurrences. So, you know, fairly quickly off the bat, each time I've finished treatment, I then end up getting re-diagnosed. And just recently, it has moved into my liver. So the prognosis has been poor each time I get re-diagnosed, but with it now in my liver, the prognosis is, you know, clearly not good. So, but that doesn't mean you sort of give up and stop. So I just keep going with things. I'm currently organising a fundraiser for Ovarian Cancer Australia, a support group that I'm with.
Oh, why wouldn't you? You get bad news. What do? You turn around and think about other people. I mean, this is. I mean, how do you do that, Tony?
You just get on with stuff. And doing things like this is important to me. It always has been, you know, whether I've got cancer or not, doing this sort of thing.
Well, you're more than just a person with cancer, right?
Yeah.
You're a person too.
Well, yeah. And so helping a group that's helped me and so many women like me is really important. And I've been planning this since the end of last year. So, and in fact, came out of a CD launch that we did with a song that Emma got us to do with one of the support groups with Brecan. And we did a music therapy session there, and it led to recording. Within a two-hour session, we had told our stories, done some singing, wrote a song and recorded it.
That's very
Emma's
efficient.
Guidance. It's amazing, yeah.
It's my specialty.
Well, what do you reckon you could come up with in the next 10 minutes?
Okay, tell me a story.
Well, I have many stories to tell. Sally Nova's got a very good story to tell.
Yes,
if you make a song about that.
I think that's Rabia
the opera.
Yeah, it's definitely an opera.
Have you got Warnie the musical? I don't see why.
anything's possible. So what? Is it a way of distracting yourself from your medical problems, or is it more than that? Is it spiritual? What role is the music playing?
The music, well, for me, I've always loved singing. Not that I can necessarily, I'm not a singer, but singing has always given me a sense of well-being and a sense of happiness. And so why shouldn't that continue once I've got a diagnosis that that obviously isn't good, and it can only help more? So I don't consider it spiritual. I consider it just healing in itself and fun.
It's not healing your cancer, though.
No, it's not healing my cancer, but it's healing me emotionally. It's healing me, just making me feel happy is just an incredible sense of relief and helps you cope with everything you've got to do day to day. It does distract you
too. Is it a bit like those laughing clubs? Have you seen them?
I've heard of them, yeah.
Yeah, there's one across the road from my place. It's astonishing. Every weekend I go out and I hear...
No, they're just laughing at you.
Is that what it is?
No, they're laughing with him.
But without wanting to make this too contrived, we've been talking about religion, and it sounds like song and music is playing in your life the role that religion plays in some other people's lives at a time of great need and distress.
I suppose that's not a way of looking at it. I hadn't considered that, but it is. Music, dance, song, yeah, it does play for me, possibly.
So what do you do, Emma, as a music therapist? What do you actually do?
Well, I work at the Royal Melbourne. I've been there for quite some time now. But I met Tony at a sort of a community group called Brecan. And my job is to go into a room. I've never met a bunch of women. They've just started working with women with gynecological cancers. Go in there, meet them, hear their stories, and create something from that. So the idea...
How do you do that?
How do I do it? I listen very carefully. I try and make it fun. I believe that...
What, make ovarian cancer fun?
No, make people expressing their stories fun. So there are a bunch of women that have never... I think most of you hadn't met each other before.
Some of us had, but yeah.
And so they're in a room together and we've only got 2 hours, and how can we make some sort of connection? And when people tell their stories and they're supported, I mean, of course, there was a lot of tears, I remember, as we went around the room, but we get them to use their voices, you know, reconnect with themselves. And then from that, we created a song.
How do you write a song in 2 hours? Do you go in with... I don't know, backing tracks or something? Like
no. Well, this is actually an area that I specialise in. So, right. In fact, I've even written, we said about an opera, but I did write an opera with 4 patients with cancer. So the idea is that I believe that people have their own sort of sense of musicality. So I listen to them. Their actual art is probably getting all the sort of workshop stuff down to verse chorus sort of situation.
Yep.
And then from there, I feed them examples. What style would you like it in? I'll start playing the guitar and singing. Do you like it like that? No, yes, no. So, and then you can quite quickly write a song.
And do these patients have any musical ability necessarily?
Some do, some don't. You don't have to be musical to benefit from music therapy. I'm doing my PhD on it, so.
Right.
Yeah, quite a bit of research. Because you were talking about, you know, it's obviously not going to get rid of your ovarian cancer, but I'm a big believer in quality of life, and it's people certainly report that it increases their quality of life working in that sense.
So it's making the quality of life better whilst you're dealing with the bad news, but you don't go so far as to say it... Well, because there are people who say that making people's quality of life better when they face a terminal illness, in fact, helps deal with the disease as well.
Yes.
Do you go that far?
Well, look, I've seen it happen. I've worked to... You know, I've been working there for 11 years now, so I have seen a lot of incredible stories. I've seen people live way beyond what they were told. Not that people don't say you've got 2 weeks now, but people say, look, you know,
I've
don't
got a
expect
friend.
To see Christmas.
I've got a friend who's just lived 10 years longer than anyone said he would.
He lived 5 years, yeah.
And he says it was meditation. Well, he's dead now, but he says it was meditation, diet. He was incredibly open. He wasn't proselytising or anything, but he was fit and he was active almost to the end, and he was absolutely sure that he said it was lifestyle that changed the doctor's outlook on him.
Yeah, and the idea too that I think sometimes people get a really severe diagnosis, you know, like Tony has had, and what I admire about Tony is she just keeps on living, and I think that's important. I think sometimes in society we don't do that. We sort of go, oh, that person's really unwell, and one of my jobs is to give them other things to do too. So if you've been living your life and you're a mum and you're picking up kids from school and all your sort of meaning's gone. So through music, people can reconnect with meaning, and I think that increases their quality of life.
Does it only work with people who are looking?
Looking for it?
Yeah.
No, not necessarily.
Because it's like religion in a way, I think. You know, if people are looking, then they'll find something. They might find religion, they might find music, they might find meditation. But you've got to be looking.
Well, sorry to interrupt. Tell us the story about, we were talking about this in your green room just before we came in. Tell us the story about...
Green room? You mean in the corridor?
The sofa.
In the barn.
Yeah. The story about the woman who was in a coma.
Yes, this was someone I'd worked with for many years, and in fact she was involved in the opera that we wrote. She was very ill and was in a coma, and I went to see her at her family's request, and the nurse said, oh, look, she can't hear anything you're doing. And I said, oh, that's okay, I don't mind, I'm quite happy to play. And I started to play, and she started to cry. And then the nurse sort of perked up a bit, and then 2 days later she started to show signs of, you know, recovery. There's certain things they do, like they move their eyes a bit more, and... And she woke up and she said, oh, I could hear Emma singing. And I thought, oh, I might as well come back for a bit. And she was alive for 4 more days, saw her family, and then she passed away. So there's some...
Are you familiar with the research on this? Because there are a lot of stories to do with music like that.
Yeah.
Whether it's with kids or sick people or whatever.
Well, there's a fair bit of research into stroke and coma arousal. So she would have been at a point where she was maybe she was going to come round anyway. And people often do report that they do hear things, even though they're told that they can't hear. And I think one of the problems with doing a lot of research with that too is, as we were saying earlier, we don't really have the sort of machines that can look at the brain's activation. And we've certainly got the machines that go ping as you sit at the bedside. And, oh, sorry, I've certainly seen people's oxygen saturation levels go up when I play, who are in a coma. So that's, you know, they're sitting on 80 and then you start to play and it'll go up to 90, 100.
So there's something happening.
There's something happening.
You see, 300 years ago you would have been a witch.
Well, I may still be one. I know. I know, and I certainly wouldn't have lasted very long, would I?
Yeah.
I think...
We're not as clever as we think we are. We think the doctors know everything. Tony, how much do the doctors know, do you think?
I think what we all know, I mean, it's increasing, but there's so much we don't know, especially associated with the brain. Mm. You know, we just...
Does the brain control your cancer?
I can't say I know. I certainly think that... how I think and how I feel can have a huge impact on how the cancer is affecting me.
But you've got to feel that. You can't fake feeling good about it, can you?
You can't say, I'm determined, even though
I feel absolutely and utterly and thoroughly bad about this, I'm going to pretend I'm feeling well because it might then help my cancer.
Absolutely not.
When
you feel bad, you just have to go, okay, that's how I'm feeling right now. I'm having a really bad day or a really bad moment or a really bad... few days, whatever it is, and you shouldn't try and deny that because...
And what helps at that moment?
What actually I've found helping is actually saying, okay, that's how I feel. That's what it is right now. I'm crying, I'm feeling a lot of anxiety, I'm feeling a lot of fear, because if you try and fight that, you end up feeling anxiety about the fact that you're feeling anxiety. And so to actually say, okay, you know, hello, that's how I feel right now, and not deny it, actually helps you move through it. Mm.
Do you find that you're spending a lot of your energy making other people feel better about how you're feeling? You know, reassuring. I had experience with a friend recently who had cancer, who's got, you know, 4 kids and a loving husband and a million friends. And she seemed to be spending all her time reassuring other people that she was okay and that it was going to be okay. And I just thought that must have been so draining and must have required her to just always be putting up a brave face and worrying about how everyone else was feeling because they were upset for her, you know.
I think that's a real pitfall that people do fall into. I can't say I do. Mm. I'm incredibly honest about where I'm at, how I'm feeling.
How did you get to do that?
Other people can look after themselves.
But how did you get to do that? Because plenty of people aren't when they've got either chronic illness or terminal diseases.
I think I'm just pathologically honest. Possibly too honest for my own good.
Were you always like that before the cancer?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Honesty that I think can get me and has got me into trouble at times. And
what do you mean?
Well, just experiences I've had. And people often don't want to know sometimes, and I say it anyway. And,
go on, say something now.
Well, I kind of am.
The whole reason you're here is because you're honest.
That's right. And creating, I'm not one for denial, although there have been moments where I've felt I've needed to be in it just to get me through the next stage. But I believe in adapting to whatever challenge I'm given, however that, you know, it sometimes can take days to adapt to that challenge. But
don't you do the why me kind of thing?
Never.
But that's absolutely normal. If there's anything that's normal, that's normal for someone in your situation.
Not normal for me. It's kind of like, oh, okay, I've been diagnosed with that. That's what it is. What have I got to do to get on with things? And that's probably how I've approached my life. But I've never considered why me. I've never, you know, there are moments when I feel a bit sorry for myself, but I've never...
You're forgiven.
I have never been angry about getting diagnosed with cancer. There have been moments of anger at myself and about this just being sick. More anger associated with the fact that I can't do the things I want to do.
The frustration.
The fact that I can't exercise if I want to do, the frustration. But never have been angry. I've never said why me. It's, to me, that's a waste.
You look like a woman with 50 years of life ahead of you. You look so healthy, so fit, so kind of bright, colourful. It's hard to fathom that you wouldn't have 50 years of life.
It is, and I think that some of the things that... it's a blessing, in a way.
Must also be a curse.
It is a curse as well. Well, I wouldn't say a curse, but people find it harder, including my family and friends, find it difficult to actually accept that I'm sick and things could turn around at any moment. And it's hard to correlate that with someone who looks well. But I'm finding the women I'm meeting through this process all look...
Often look well.
Often look really, really well. And that's great because it means you can get out and about. Mm. Nobody stares at you looking like you're a bit of an alien, which when I had my bald head and got out and about, sort of it did look, even though I looked healthy... It's a bit to adjust to a woman getting around with a bald head, but, you know...
Could always have worn a burqa.
I was thinking then when you were talking about... You were saying that she'd try and keep other people happy, and there's the song that I wrote with that group, the opening line is, before I thought too much about others than about myself, and then the main chorus is that it's actually called Resilience, and the women all agreed that through this process they'd been given back themselves.
Mm-hmm. So, which is interesting, and I want to talk about this positive outlook business, because it's kind of, you know, everywhere you go when you talk with people who are involved in, you know, chronic illness or cancers and the like, you maintain a positive outlook. You can't go to the shop and buy one. But I want to tell people about your fundraiser first,
yes,
Tony.
Yes,
because that's one of the reasons you're here. Because you're incredibly brave and honest, and you're also here because you're doing something for other people to hear some ideas and suggestions, but you're also putting on a show.
That's right. I mean, creating awareness amongst the community about ovarian cancer is important, and I suppose we haven't really kind of got there, but that's okay. Just hearing that the term is creating awareness. But I am, on Sunday, this Sunday, doing a fundraiser with the Darabin Songwriters Guild. They've very kindly donated one of their monthly sessions for me to run this fundraiser for Ovarian Cancer Australia, which is a support group, one of the ones that I've had a lot to do with, and they receive no government funding, federal or state, and so they're just relying on, you know, corporate or you know, people giving donations or fundraisers. So
where and when?
It's at Bar 303 in Northcote, High Street Northcote, 303 High Street Northcote.
Coincidentally, isn't it good that the number on the street coincides with the name of the bar?
They fantastic. Must have been relieved when they found that property.
It makes it a lot easier. And it's great. We've got some great performers happening there. We've got raffle, we've got silent auction, we've got donations. Getting donations is really hard unless you know people and contacts, but a lot of door knocking's been going on to get donations. And
so, are you going to be writing songs?
There'll be no writing songs there, but all the people performing will have written the stuff themselves.
Okay.
So they're all singer songwriters, and we are in fact doing Resilience. Emma will be there to help those of us that are going to be there to do Resilience. And we'll be, you know, doing that early on in the piece. It starts at 3:30.
So at 3:30 at Bar 303, 303 High Street, Northcote.
Goodness,
there's a theme in all
there
of this.
There is a theme.
That's this Sunday at 303 High Street, Northcote, at 3:30 at Bar 303 if you want to join in to the Songwriting Guild. Where do you get this positive outlook from? Emma, where do you, how do you nurture it? How do you draw it out?
Well, I think you allow those pyjama days too. Like as you were saying, you know, sometimes they feel dreadful, and the beauty of music is it can go with that. It can go with the really down days.
It like
can
you put on the Leonard Cohen and
just
kind of
let
sit
it all
there and go.
Sometimes I see people and they just cry the whole session.
Sure.
And it's a real outlet. So I think it's allowing people to just be themselves.
Can I ask, in that situation where they are just crying, do you write music at that point?
Well, sometimes I'm just playing them their favourite songs and
right,
they're crying, but sometimes in the middle of a session, particularly if you picture that they're writing a song because they're in palliative care and they're writing it for their two little children.
Right.
You know, and this is often a common scenario. So that's going to be an incredibly emotional experience. And I sit with them and help them through that. You know, part of the training of music therapists is that you're able to cope with those issues and help them deal with them, you know, and validate them and then create something beautiful that's long-lasting. I mean, that song we did in 2 hours, it still has a life of its own that just keeps going. So
have you recorded it?
Yeah. I've recorded most of the stuff I've done, yeah.
Look, it's fabulous work that you do, Emma, and it's good to be able to speak to someone about, you know, the not discussed parts of the treatment of cancer. Tony, I salute you. Good luck.
Thank you.
You did cry. You said you wouldn't, but there was a tear there a few times.
Yeah, almost.
You're a terrific person. You're doing good things for other people, and I hope that means good things for you too. Good luck. Tony, Emma, Sally, Wally, thank you all for coming.
The Conversation Hour podcasts are available at abc.net.au/Melbourne. Subscribe now and you'll receive automatic updates with special guests, interesting interviews. It's a bit of fun. You'll be mad not to subscribe. abc.net.au/Melbourne.